Okay, so it seems like there's a pretty drastic change from your earliest work to your most recent work, and I was wondering what exactly brought about that change, and how do you think your work's developed over the years?
Well, that's of course probably the most interesting question anybody will ask for the rest of my life. But and it's going to embrace a lengthy answer. So let's look at the careers of any of the photographers that we admire in this library. They are all pretty well established by the presentation of what we'll call a solid body of work at a given time, usually what we'll call their early work. I have this theory called the curse of the early work, which is that John Czarkowski, the curator at the MoMA, no longer with us, stated that, in his opinion, there was a 7-year period in which a photographer did his or her most creative work. But if we talk about Cartier-Bresson, Henri told me, he said, "I've only done 15 great photographs in my surreal period." Robert Frank did the Americans, Larry Clark did Tulsa, et cetera, et cetera. We know that many great photographers announce their presence with a unique, discrete, contiguous body of work. Then that establishes them in their forever triangulated position, evaluated according in relationship to the early stuff. Is Teenage Lust as good as Tulsa? Was Lines of My Hand as good as the Americans? Et cetera, et cetera. So this is something, an artist doesn't exist without his or her early work. But you have to find a way within the integrity of the early work and the visual signature and who you are. You then, it takes many years to arrive at that position, by the way. But once you've sort of arrived at where you know who and what you are photographically, in my case it took close to 12 years, you then have an even much more complicated, complex series of motions ahead of you, which is remaining true to your early work and continuing to evolve. If you don't evolve, they say, "Well, he did a great thing when he was young." If you do evolve, they'll say, "Well, you know, I like his early work better." I mean, I find myself doing it all the time. I do it to other artists continually. You know, did Dwayne Michaels ever make a greater sequence than Things Are Queer? If you know that one, The Little Miniature Bathroom, et cetera, et cetera. It goes on and on and on. However, I've been privileged to know all the great photographers of my generation, all the masters, welcomed me. There was a different atmosphere then, less competition, there were more. And I would talk about, there's only one conversation to have in photography, and it's called the creative process. That is the subject. You're essentially asking, you could rephrase that question: how would you define your creative process from starting then to now? So inherent in every body of work, my first announced work was a somnambulist. I mean, originally I was a photojournalist, and I was in Magnum when I was young, but then that wasn't me. It was all formative. I arrived with a somnambulist, my sequence about the dream. At the end of the somnambulist were a few pictures left over, which were indicating something else, telling me to go on to do Deja Vu, which is my second book in my trilogy. So there are harbingers in the work. But one of the things is that photographers don't spend enough time looking at their own work. It's so easy to just push that little thing and let somebody else decide, which is what the commercial photographer does. He or she lets the editor select from their contact. Working on the somnambulist for 3 years, I learned how to look at my photographs. I had an instructor, John Collier, and I went to art school for a semester. And one of the things John Collier told me was how to read a photograph. He could take up any picture. He could take this picture upside down and go for 45 minutes talking, looking at the shape, looking at the color, looking at the contrast, look at the scale, looking at the diagonal, look at the architecture, look at the potential typographical forms, look at the triangles next to the circles, next to the squares, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I learned how to look at my photographs. And they would always tell me where I was going to go next. And then I produced a Andre Kertész told me we became friends, and he said I could visit him anytime, and I would go see him unannounced. He would receive me. And one time he said, a photographer must learn how to photograph everything. Everything. He says, I see new things every day. And he was very old, deep in his 80s when he told me that. What happens is that I admire the work of many of my contemporaries. I admire anything done well in photography. I don't consider myself to be the only photographer, although some of my contemporaries consider themselves to be. I like anything done well in photography. But one of the things I know that I do that many of my colleagues don't is that I have the broadest spectrum of potential subject matter. I might wind up doing a picture of this microphone or this clamp or this gaffer tape. I will photograph anything in order to see if I can. I don't want to see how things looked photographed. That was Winogrand's thing. I want to see if I can see anything well enough. This little square of gaffer tape, if properly perceived, could in fact function as a valid, legitimate subject matter for a photograph. Do you have any other shorter questions?
How do you decide whether you're going to shoot in black and white or in color?
Well, I like photographing in all three. I tell you what happened. When I was started working a lot in France, in the middle 80s, and it was all shooting Kodachrome transparencies, and then you'd have to have internegatives and stuff. It was expensive going to dye transfer. Color got easy when color negative came out. Now this is an idea. I'll probably say a lot of this, repeat a lot of what I'm saying today in my lecture tonight. Let's assume you have so-called reality existing in front of you, 100% scale, three dimensions, and color. Everybody follow that? All right, you make a black and white photograph, you're reducing it in scale, you're reducing it to two dimensions, and you're reducing it to black and white, you're subtracting the color. You are three steps removed from so-called reality. And a lot of content and a lot of emotional tone starts to emerge. The drama of black and white photography is a well-proven thing. Because color is only two steps away, it is less dramatic. It is harder to make a great photograph in color than it is to make a great photograph in black and white, for that specific reason. It is one degree less abstract than a black and white image. However, because of that problem, it's an incredible challenge for somebody who has 20, 30, 40 years experience in black and white, such as myself. So I continue to stay fascinated by color. That's part of the answer. The other part is that as I started working more in France and more recently in Brazil, color has a strong, you know what semiology is? Do you know that? You know that word, semiology? Semiology is the study of the language of signs in a given culture. In the West, we stop at red, go at green. That's a semiological issue. Semiology can be how we read time. Chairman Mao was the guy to put China on the watch in the 50s. Prior to that time, they were burning candles and turning over egg timers and stuff like that. Semiology is a system of signs within a culture. It has a lot to do with typography, it has a lot to do with signage, it has a lot to do with custom. So when you go to certain cultures like Brazil, everything is color. In my Brazil book, I did black and white at night for the most part. And I use color during the day. So that, in the case of that project, was your answer. In the guitar book, it depended what was the nature of that particular picture. It was a great shock when I first started. I received a commission to photograph a village in France from the mayor, who was also the doctor. And come to Ribérac and do your thing. We'd like a little color, black and white. And so I remember to this minute, the first day I went out with two Leicas, one with loaded with each. It was just all elbows and jumble. It was like I had none of my fluidity, none of my skill, none of my capabilities. But eventually I learned how. I could just grab one, I could just grab the other. It's like I can speak to you, on peut se parler en français, on peut se parler en anglais. I can go back and forth. And it's no longer a struggle. So as long as it doesn't cause a conflict in my attack, I don't have a problem going back and forth between the two. All right, somebody else asked one.
All right. how did you get the funding to start Lystrom Press, and how did you meet Larry Clark and Danny Seymour?
Well, I was in New York. I was living in the Chelsea Hotel. I'd sort of dropped out of Magnum. I was staying up very late and listening to Villa-Lobos and reading Borges. And Borges had a, you know who he is, that writer, Borges?
Yeah.
He's a fabulist. And I said, any word I didn't understand, I was going to look up in the dictionary. You know, which means about 10 times a page, I would spend more time with a dictionary in my hand. But lustrum was a word. It's an ancient purification ritual that takes place every 5 years in now defunct cultures, ancient cultures. So when it came time to put a name on my book, I called it Lustrum Press. And it had a literary ring to it. Larry and I hit town. He was just back from Vietnam. And I originally went to New York with $200, and I was going to spend a week at Chelsea. You could spend a week, you'd get by for $200 in a week in New York. And I said, I'm not going back. I just said, I am not going to go back. I hate it in L.A. I'm too sophisticated. I'm just going to stay here. I'm going to make it. So I had a week's rent and $200 to make it in New York. But I had already been in and out. I mean, I had presentations to Magnum. I had presentations to various editors. Now, Larry had just gotten back from Vietnam, where he had been in the Army. And we met within a week or two. We just had a show together in Berlin at the Helmut Newton Foundation, and we were reminiscing a lot. But anyway, we just clicked, and we were just completely different, but we had the same passionate love of an aspect of content and quality in photography. He's a 35 worker, I'm a 35 worker. His parents had been kidnappers. That, you know, they did baby portraits. You know, you still go door to door and sell coupons and photograph your baby. It's called kidnapping. So he grew up, knew photography very well. I learned photography at 17, 18 in the Navy, and by the time I was 25, 26, I could zone out 8x10 negatives. I had a lot of technique, useless technique, available at my disposal. So we just got along very well together, and we scuffled, and we were got our toehold in New York together, and then he lived with me for a while in my loft after I did Somnambulist, and I said, man, your Tulsa pictures are great, do a dummy and we can get something to happen. So he did this dummy, and I had been assisting Robert Frank. That was one of the things that happened early in my New York thing, and Robert had this other young guy around him, Danny Seymour, from the Gardner Foundation. You probably know his background. And so Danny had just inherited some money, which he was determined to get rid of as fast as he could. And so when Larry had the dummy of Tulsa, Danny, who had certain personal weakness for drugs himself, wanted to publish it. I mean, we're talking about $5,000 is what it took to do it. So he put up the money. And so Danny, then I said to Danny, listen, man, you do a book too. And he did Loud Song. Now, I have a signed, dedicated copy of Loud Song, which somebody's offered me $75,000 for. I might be forced to part with it for that kind of money. But anyway, that's what a signed copy, it's the one he dedicated. He said, Dear Ralph, we have fought and become friends over this book, but the fact is I couldn't have done it without you. Love, Danny. And so Loud Song, which was kind of it was single pass with varnish, it wasn't double. He laid it out in minutes because he had worked at the Detroit Free Press in the 60s, which is a real underground radical, you know, weatherman, Black Panther type of. So he had a lot of layout capabilities and attitudes and interests.
Why has the photography book of that song never been reprinted?
Oh, well, you know, he died mysteriously, and he was yacht-jacked, and they never found his body, and the two guys who were on his yacht subsequently died themselves. It's all very decadent, and Loud Song wouldn't be. You see, the thing is that those books were hugely relevant and made a really big impact then. Whether or not they would make such an impact if they were to appear now is another story. What we would like to see now would be the equivalent of a Loud Song, the equivalent of Today's Tulsa, Today's Somnambulist, etc. This is a mistake a lot of young people make, you know, in trying to redo something. Do something heretofore undone. That would be my answer. I wouldn't lift a finger to republish Loud Song now. All that would do would be dilute the original edition and demystify it totally. Maybe. Ask another one.
If you had one thing to tell us that would help us become a better photographer.
What did you say?
If you had some advice to give us to become better photographers, what would it be?
Well, I know that you received an assignment to photograph in my style or in Robert Frank's style or something like that. Well, let me tell you something. You know, I spent a lot of time in Europe, and the minute I could start traveling, as I became more established, I went there to learn languages and proceed with art history studies and just to become studied in the classical manner. One of the things I discovered, you can go to the Louvre today, the Louvre is a great museum, and you'll see people sitting there in an easel copying paintings under the assumption they're going to learn something by doing that. Well, this is called the academic approach, and I'll tell you why. When you have a great culture, like culture of France, culture of Italy, these cultures are very interested in prolonging and continuing their patrimony. I have received many commissions from the Ministry of Culture of France. I have another one just came in a couple weeks ago. They want me to keep photographing in France because that has a way of enhancing the culture and prolonging and continuing its thing. This is called the academic approach. I come from America where we have no culture. We're only 200 years old. We don't have a typical American culture. What we have is a typical American necessity to be completely original. Now, what do you want to do? You want to be a second-rate, third-rate, fourth-rate imitation of somebody, or do you want to be a first-rate self? So the first thing I learned, I worked for Dorothy Lange when I was 21. And then I worked for Robert Frank when I was about 24, 25, 26. These are great people. And at one time or another, more than once, they said to me, you have to be... I asked Dorothea to sign a book for me. She gave me a book, Death of a Valley, one of her books, Aperture thing. And earlier in that day, I told her I wanted to be a surrealist photographer. In this book, she dedicated Dil Raffel. You can only be yourself. The rest is just a name. And then Robert, we were working on me and my brother, and he said, I might fall flat on my face in this one, but I'm going to do something like it's never been done. And the thing is, if you want to be mediocre in photography, you can get there very quickly. It's the nature of the medium. You can achieve mediocrity very fast by the time you're seniors. What's your average age? What are you?
17.
What are you?
16. 23.
Well, by the time you're in your 20s, you can have arrived at mediocrity very easily. I went in the Navy when I was 17, and they sent me to photo school when I was late 17 or early 18. I started studying then. If you want to have a hollowed place on the PRC bookshelf, you know, you're gonna have to do something that's not a variation on somebody else's theme. You can either perform a variation on a previously announced theme, or you can announce a theme. It's called having a visual signature. So that's what I think about. That's in terms of my philosophy of education and photography is study architecture, study art history, study dance, study painting, study languages, become cultured, study music theory. That will make you a photographer. The history of photography is right there, pretty small. There's a lot of dupes. So, go ahead.
No. In your opinion, what is the biggest difference between a gallery show and seeing pictures in a book?
Well, I have an answer to that. You know, when I show my work in a gallery, which I do a lot, that's how I make a living, you know, you see the print and you see how I think about photography and how I work in photography. You see the materials, the light. When you see my work in a book, you see how I think about my photographs. And there's another factor that you have to remember, which is that when you go to a gallery, it's a social event. No matter, even if the gallery's empty, you are coming downtown, you're going to this specific site, this address, and you are functioning in a social way. And you're moving around the gallery and looking at those pictures at all different distances from you to the picture plane. When you pick up a book, you are generally under ideal circumstances. You could be in your home with your best light, you can sit there, and everybody in the world is going to hold that book within 2 or 3 inches distance. Near side a little bit, far side a little bit, but I know that I can do scale things in that book that everybody's going to get. Everybody's going to see. Whether or not they like it doesn't matter. I know that I can do things with that page and it's going to be perceived in a universal way. So that, I continue to stay fascinated with the book. I have one coming out in fall and another one in next winter. So it also remains, I'm of the generation which the only way you could get known was through a book. There's no other, you know. Now the book is, I still remain fascinated with it, and to get my first one out was such a struggle that after that enormous battle, it became easy for me to get books out. You know, it just came my way because I struggled so hard to get the first one out.
You seem to have a lot of emphasis on hands in your photographs. Why is that? Are they symbolic for you?
Well, they're a light motif. A symbol it means it's a metaphor for something else. A light motif means it's a repeating theme. It is a way of unifying. For example, if I do a series of photographs in architecture, and there's one or two hands in it, it might harken back. My very first photograph, which I'll show from 1960, is of a hand with a cane. And it seems to be something that I refer to a lot, but I also have other leitmotifs that are woven into the fabric of my work, such as diagonals and things like that, which I'll point out in my lecture. You know. Everybody has this sort of thing. Everybody in this room has something that their eye does, because I believe that the eye is self-monitoring. It has its own intelligence. And if you look at your pictures long enough, you'll start to see things that your eye is doing, that your mind then has to come and understand and acknowledge and recognize.
Can you articulate why you think your eye is drawn to hands as a leitmotif?
Well, you know, I grew up in Hollywood. My father worked at Warner Brothers, and assistant director to Alfred Hitchcock, and I was on the set a lot. And I remember, in those days, the film was very slow, and they used these huge carbon arc lights, like big blast. And I remember watching these cameras set up what they call inserts, details of a guy dialing a phone or somebody writing with, you know, or something like that. And I remember as a kid, I'm talking about when I was maybe 9 or 10, 11 years old, being attracted to the insert. But the hand is also the hand is one thing, but also included in that fascination is bright sun, high contrast, no distortion, invisible focal length. You know, you can never tell what lens I use in my pictures. But sometimes I say I'm not going to do any hands, but then if I feel like, I mean, there's a lot of expression in a person's hand. It might also harken back to my days when I was, I wanted very much to be in Magnum, and I got in Magnum. But while I was working on it, I was studying, in those days, documentary work, photojournalism had a big role in magazines. And I think the gesture, not necessarily hands, but a gestural quality in a photograph was something that is always interesting, sort of as a point of departure. You could ask another one.
What in particular were you going for in your Brazil series?
Well, I was just doing it out of pure love of the place. I also allowed myself to be a little less formal and a little bit more documentary, out of homage to the country itself. Brazil is unlike South America. They're colonies. You feel, but Brazil is such an entity. You know, in the text I say there's 300 words for the color of your skin. You see, if America is a melting pot, we're made out of dried Lipton soup. You go to Brazil and you see these creatures. You cannot believe the beauty of humanity in Brazil because of this amazing gene pool. And then there's the incredible contrast of the poverty and the wealth, but the poor people find a way to be happy. And it goes on and on and on. I don't consider my work in Brazil finished. But now, I couldn't care less if I never went back to Europe. I was in Russia a week ago, 10 days ago. I've had it with Europe. Europe is the past. I feel at best immortal, but when I'm in South America, in Brazil, I feel young. It's the future. So I want to start photographing more all over South America. That's my next, I'll probably, see, for me, when you're your age, time moves very slowly. It moves quicker for me. I can say I'm going to spend the next 3 or 4 years doing South America, and I'll burp twice, and those 3 or 4 years will be over. You know, because I'm, you know, 50 prints later. You know, so I think that's where I'm headed. You know, but it's like Brazil is a culture. It's a cultural event, the way France, it's different. The rest of South America is more or less Spanish, more or less colonial, a little more Indian, a little less. Brazil has a cultural identity that smacks you right in the eye. You cannot avoid it. You cannot ignore it. You cannot but adore it, you know. Very exciting. It's also dangerous in a way. But that quality of danger requires a kind of alertness. It's exactly the same way that I am when I'm on the street photographing. It's the same state of awareness. So I can move effortlessly through that society. I've been to the favelas and everything, you know. In the course of a day, I'll be at some guy's house with his helicopter, and I'll end up this evening in some samba club in the favela where guys have guns to shoot. It's just the Wild West. And the Amazon, Jesus, I went to the Amazon. I've never seen anything like that in Manaus. It's like a Joseph Conrad novel. It's just so far away. Just leave it alone. You know, I mean, Manaus is this port city in the Amazon where up in the jungle, miles and miles and miles and miles, there's all these endless tributaries and villages and these flat-bottom river boats pass these villages, pick up people, come down to Manaus to buy Coca-Cola and flour and stuff to take back, you know. And these boats are, there may be like 6 decks about as high as this little room, and with hammocks. Everybody's hanging in hammocks and stuff they buy, and take back and sell. And then, of course, if they have any money left, they go crazy in these clubs at night where, you know, these clubs are so wild, you don't even want to touch a glass or a Coke bottle. You know, it's just amazing. It's amazing. Don't want to tip my hand here. What else?
When you're taking pictures, do the pictures make the concepts of your books, or do you already have a concept in mind when you're taking them?
Well, I'll answer that, and you'll hear this again tonight. When I was working for Dorothea, I was doing all her printing, and one day she said, "You may show me your work," after about a year. So I showed her my pictures, some of which are in my early workbooks, you know, you'd recognize. She said, "I see your problem. You have no point of departure." And I said, "That's true, Mrs. Lang. What is a point of departure?" She said, if you're going down to the drugstore to buy toothpaste and you have your camera in your hand, the possibility of intersecting an event that you could photograph are far greater than if you just go stand on the street corner waiting for something to happen. With this advice in mind, I returned to the street corner for about 7-8 years. And it was only when I started working on the Somnambulist that I understood point of departure. Since that time, I always have a point of departure. Any photograph I make is part of a larger whole. I have many ongoing series. I do workshops where, you know, I photograph the nude. All right, fine. I've been photographing the figure for 40 years, and then I'm doing a big book with Passion, you know, 500-pager, one of those big things. So all of a sudden, the point of departure for all those nudes, I knew eventually I would bring out a very large thing, and now it's happening. Always have a point of departure. Dorothea taught me that, and it has been the backbone of my career. It's the architecture upon which my entire body of work is built. We don't just drift around taking little snapshots. It's always serious work. Always part of something. In any given book, the sum of the parts equals, the total equals more than the sum of its parts. You've heard that expression before. A book is an object. 48 pictures by Ralph, no. The Somnambulist, aha. Recontextualization of a photograph. So when you're photographing, you keep little thoughts like this in mind. If I say, take a picture in here, there's a lot of things to take a picture of. If I take a picture of a smiling teenager, we know where to go. There's one right there. There's one right there. So you see, point of departure. There's a lot of things you can photograph in this room, but if I say, show me the essence of gaffer tape, you stop looking over there. You go right, there's some right there. And that tends to correspond harmoniously, resonates in concord with what photography does anyway. Photography is specific as opposed to general. It is precise as opposed to random. It does reflect a decision as opposed to a non-decision, even when you're trying to express a non-decision. What does that mean? Ask another one.
What are some of your points of departure that you're currently working on? Or what would you...
People, children, and dogs. No, right now, I'm finishing up a portraiture book on guitarists, avant-garde guitarists. And so that's coming to an end. I have to finish up this. You know, I sent Tashin 700 nudes, but now that I have a book deal going, I'm doing a workshop in Chicago next month. I'll attack that. I'll definitely get a few more new ones there. That's going on. I also I'm very active as a musician, and I compose and I play a lot and I perform. I made a film called Ich bin die Nacht, I am the night. and it's all footage shot in Berlin at night, and I perform this composition in front of it, and in the film, while it's playing, there's some of my photographs from Berlin. I started this composition in Russia. I always travel with a guitar and a small recording device, and notes from the Kremlin. So that might become a... I'm looking for the relationship in the broadest sense, very specifically, the relationship between my photographs and my music. And I'm actively engaged in all that, all day. I have some very big shows coming up. I'm going to Cuba in May for an exhibition, Retro. I have a show in Museum of Fine Arts in Houston in the fall. One in Budapest. So in the course of travel for these exhibitions, I will pursue unexpected examples. I might get a guitarist in Cuba, you know, some avant-garde, because the real reason I wanted the Cuba show, outside of it's a hip line on the resume, is that notwithstanding Castro's situation, they have produced Afro-Cuban jazz, which is the most sophisticated in the world. See, there's a book up there next to Rochengo called Currents. See that? That book right there to the right of Rochengo, two books to the right of Rochenko. In that book is the best article that's ever been written about me, ever. It's this guy really got it right, and it's not very often. It goes way back. Here's Duane Michael's Things Are Queer. I was so thrilled when this came out. I still refer to it. Howard Smigula. I never met him. I wrote him a note, and he thanked me. I've always wanted to get this guy to write more about me. But that's, you know, not how it works. So, I have a lot of ideas in mind. Yeah, here, it starts here. It's a really, really good article. It's not an article, it's an essay. But it's up to this, up to there, you know. It's of a certain period. So, ask another one.
In a lot of your photographs, there's this sense of, like, something either moving into or out of the frame. It's mm-hmm. rarely centered, and there seems to kind of be a focus on, like,
where'd you get that question?
I mean, like, I wrote it down to ask, but initially I just noticed when we were looking through your photos, especially in The Somnambulist, just...
Well, let's talk about the frame as a concept. I work with a Leica. I have it here. With a Leica, you can see what's inside the frame as well as what's outside of the picture frame. With a reflex, you only see what the camera sees. You could follow it around the world until it discovered a photograph for you. With the Leica, you see something, you continue your relationship to the subject. The frame can either compress data, like my Priest photograph, which I'll talk about tonight, or you can put figures on the edge of the frame and suggest activity outside of the frame. Most photographers just put the picture, the subject, in the center of the frame. Right there. There's one right there. There's one right here, except he makes use of the corners. That's Edward Weston. He makes use of the corner there. I am always looking for the vector that will produce the greatest tension, visual tension. I want my pictures to be snapped like the head of a drum. If you've ever, you know, run your finger, you know, I want that tautness. The reason, I've worked with the Leica, basically with a 50 for my entire career, because I'm going to continue to learn that instrument. And 35 millimeters is about the frame. 2 1/4 is about non-frame. 2 1/4 was invented so that a commercial photographer in the studio could put a subject here, and the art director could put typography here, here, or here. 2 1/4 is essentially a commercial camera. And the people who function best with it, there have been exceptions. D.N. Arbus is probably the best one of the bunch, but you never get the kind of tensions you're referring to with 2 1/4, very seldom. Do you suggest activity transpiring outside of the picture plane. I also spend a long time, you see, every one of these pictures that we see is creating a little picture window in space in which we have the illusion of the surface and then perspective starting from the surface back. It's an early Renaissance idea. Suppose you wanted to make a picture that started here and came forward of the picture plane. Happens all the time. Color field does it. There's a slight whiff of that in Warhol's collaging. You could opine that maybe this red thing is floating in front. So when you're thinking about the frame, you are simultaneously addressing the picture plane. What are your intentions? You see, in this book, in this library, I would suggest that 99.99% of the photographers in the photographs, they're trying to show you something in their photograph. Photographers want to show something in their pictures. I don't want to show anything. I want to see something in my pictures. I'm not trying to show anything. I'm trying to see something. It sets you up in a different mental space. You know, I'm having exactly the same conversation with you that I would have with a 75-year-old master. I'm just telling you what I think. I'm not modifying any of my thoughts for the fact that you guys are so-called beginners. Because I think that your generation is very sophisticated visually. You're plugged in, you have your internet, you have your cell phones. It's interesting to see who the great visions will be of your generation. Who is going to show us something that we haven't seen before? Because that's essentially, who's going to see something that we've never seen before? Who's going to see something that they haven't been shown before? Hence my disagreement with the idea of learning photography by emulating people you admire. All you're doing is putting another feather in their cap. I know it's a valid teaching tool, but I still don't like it. I could take either side of the argument very easily, but I don't think it leads to anything except learning what somebody else did. You know, you can learn what somebody else did, or you can discover what you will do, what you do. It's a presence of this as opposed to the absence of that. Anybody can back into a photograph. It's a pathetically easy medium for that. I can look at any photograph in any book and tell you how they did it. And then subsequently, if I had to prove it, the stakes were high enough, I could just... Well, that starts with these landscapes. There's beautiful... We're not interested in that. It's the results that count. Bill Brandt. I went to see a Bill Brandt. He was one of the guys I went to see, and I specifically to thank him for having had the courage to change his work at 50. He immediately sat me down, and we started having a ritual of tea. Every time I was in London, I would visit Brandt for tea. And he'd answer, we'd discuss things. He loved being imitated. He thought it was great. And if he didn't want to answer a question, he'd just laugh. I said, why do you like being imitated? He'd go, oh. If he didn't want to answer a question, he'd just, oh. And if he would, but when he did answer the question, it was very interesting. So you see, he was a 19th century gentleman. He believed in an academic approach to things. He was a product of the academy. You know, suppose some of you become Rhodes scholars. You know, and that might lead you to becoming majors in Greek philosophy, and you spend the rest of your life studying Plato. You know, that would be a great, and you might write a definitive work on Plato. Could be you. And that would then add to the body of knowledge of Platonic thought. Culture functions that way. That's an aspect of culture. You cannot have an avant-garde without an establishment. And if there's establishment, assuming it's not totally moribund, it's going to have its leading edge. culture is like a yeast culture. It's like a mushroom. It's expanding. It's growing. It's spreading. And the semiotics of American culture today are in such an exponential watershed that we don't even know what's, for example, things like music, the MP3 phenomena, the record companies, nobody even knows the future of music. It's amazing. Now let's consider all the kinds of art you can imagine. Visual arts, spoken art, cinema, dance, sculpture, architecture, etc., etc. Without a shadow of a doubt, the most abstract language spoken on the planet is music. Yet, everybody in the world understands music. So, the most abstract thing about existence is understood by more people than any other art. Music is understood well by far more people than understand visual arts or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, theatrical arts, anything. Music is something that everybody in the world understands. You can play a 6/8 blues to some aboriginal in a Stone Age culture in Micronesia, and he'll start dancing. You know, it's just one of those things. So, take that fact and counter it with the fact that nobody knows what the hell the future of music is in society. All we know is that more people are listening to music than ever before. Even though it's MP3, the bandwidth is very, very, very narrow. It's not like hearing a symphony live. You're getting some watered down Kool-Aid. You're not even, you know, it's really, however, with earbuds, sounds like the real thing. More people are listening to more music than ever before, but they're getting less of it, but it doesn't matter. You know, it's no longer a question of the king inviting 60 aristocrats to hear a Mozart quartet. Everybody hears music now, yet nobody knows the future of music. The bigger it gets, instead of being concrete, it seems that the larger it gets, the more amorphous it becomes. It's almost like air or water. It's very, very homogeneous. And so I'm interested in how something as abstract as music is so clearly perceived. Nothing else can even go near that. It's something we share like breathing or eating or sleeping. It's really way up there. Theory of evolution, I'm not too strong on this, too boned up on it, but the theory of evolution is that as we evolved from the sea and became mammals, we were crawling along the edge of the shore, and to this day serpents and earthbound animals perceive everything from their throat, from the vibrations of them. Now snakes develop a tongue, but before it was all coming up through the throat, vibrations from the land coming up through the throat. And we then evolve speech, which is throat-based, it's vibration-based. I'm speaking to you in a series of frequencies which you agree to process around as an alphabet, syntax, grammar, and we call it English. I could say the same thing to a bird, and the bird would interpret those vibrations differently. It's thought that in music that birds don't sing, they're sending frequencies back and forth to one another. But humans are the only organisms that can take vibration, sound vibration, and convert it to emotion. So we're back to the fact that more people can take sound vibration. Everybody in the world, almost, can do that. And it's also thought that people were beating on hollowed logs before they could even speak, before a language had even formed. So right after vibrations comes rhythm. Now, not everybody in the world understands rhythm. It's very hard to, but almost everybody can whistle or hear or recognize something. So what's the relationship between that and photography? Well, almost everybody in the world nowadays can read a photograph. I do tell the story of this missionary, a little seaplane, going over this Micronesian culture, wanted to convert them, so he had a bunch of 8x10 headshots. He threw them out of the plane down to the village and landed the seaplane. Came up to the village and they ate him. Now, either they thought he was sending the menu, or he thought they could read photographs. But they didn't realize that was a picture of him. But that wouldn't happen today, because almost everybody can read a photograph. When I was your age, that wasn't true. When I was your age, that was just starting to become the case. Those magazines were getting distributed in a wide enough way. That was before television, before the two-dimensional image, moving image. Things you take for granted are relatively young. This medium you're studying, photography, it's not even 200, 1839, you know, what is that? It's not even 200 years old, is it? So, on the other hand, recorded music's even younger. Recorded music's around 1915, 1920. So it's not even 100 years old, but the history of music is as far back as you can possibly imagine. So there's some people who think that let the recording industry consume itself, let recorded music as a concept evaporate, because music is, by its inherent nature, ephemeral. It's designed to be played, listened to, and then, because that's how it was for almost all of its, more than 99.99.99% of its existence. It's been ephemeral, performed live, and dissipates. I look for these, I'm interested in these relationships. You know, I don't come to any answers. I don't get answers to my questions in my photography or music, but I get much better definitions of questions. You know, I get to make a composition that defines the question for me. I'm not playing Moon River by Harry Mancini or something like that, or Want to Hold Your Hand. I'm trying to find a melody that would perhaps ask the question for me in a slightly more understandable way. So you can do that in photography. You can do it in anything. You just need a medium. That's why it's called a medium. In this room right now, there's radio, TV, cell phones. We don't have our medium turned on. Turn on your cell phone, you got it. Turn on your radio, you got it. Load up your camera, you got it. Put a pencil in your hand, you got it. You need a medium through which all this can speak. And at such a time, you then become able to express things that you couldn't express otherwise. You need a medium to express what it is you're thinking about. What is your feeling about? I was a weird kid. I didn't even know I was trying to be an artist. It was only when I started getting a little satisfaction in my photographs that I understood all the weird feelings I had when I was a chubby adolescent. You know. Any more? You know, I have a lot of these books, and I've seen almost all of them. The thing about going into libraries to find something I haven't seen before. I had a great signed library. I recently sold it. I wasn't doing anything with it. I sold it for a fortune. I had like 600 books signed to me from all the great photographers. And I hadn't touched them for years. That guy made me a huge offer. But I'm only interested in my next photograph, and I'm really only interested in my next book. That's the measure of the man. That's you're only as good as your next picture. You know, that's how you can take an accurate measure. Painters and other kinds of people seem to be able to rest on their laurels. That's a beautiful Lincoln in there. I know his work very well. I have some we traded. I love Arno's work. He's a real good artist. That's the hardest thing to do. Make it as a self-portraitist, a nude self-portraitist. How many? Copeland's dead. in Arno. Can you name any others? You talk about a range of subject matter. He just keeps finding. He's got a great intelligence to discover what he does. So if you could do anything in photography, what would it be?
How do you mean that?
English spoken here.
I mean, as in what ideas would I want to get across? Or?
Well, whatever. Just whatever you think it means.
I guess when you were saying you wanted to discover the connection between your music and your photography, I write a lot, creative writing, a hell of a lot, like every day, and I guess I'd want to be able to express the same things that I can in words, in visual terms. I can't always, and it's kind of frustrating. I'd like to be able to.
Hmm. Well, you know, I have this theory that people write because they're basically thinkers, and the only way they can keep track of what they're thinking is to write it. That's true of novelists, playwrights, everything. The only thing I'm really jealous of is great thought. When I read something that's really powerful, you know, when you read something, it's sort of when you're reading up. When you're reading up, not down, you're reading up, you're basically flattering your intelligence. I realize that. You see, how differently do you approach your personal projects from your commercial? I didn't do any commercial work for 30 years. And I just recently, the last couple of years after Helmut died, I was very good friends with Helmut Newton, and we used to debate it a lot, and I accepted a couple jobs out of homage to him, and I find that I don't mind doing it now, as long as it's up high enough. I mean, it'll never be more than one or two assignments a year, you know, because most of the time their ideas are too stupid. My own ideas are stupid enough. But fashion is fun for the first day because it's all glitzy and everything, but by the second day I'm bored stiff. I do a lot of workshops. It's my way of, I mean, I do two or three a year, but I've done it for a long time. And in every workshop, I want you to write this down. I asked for an answer to the following three questions. Question number one. I want a brutally frank and honest answer to where are you as a photographer? This is a message from you to you. Where are you as a photographer? Next question, number two. After you've really dug deep and really, really come up with some self-honesty, very painful. Next question is, well, where would you like to be? And question number three is, what's standing in your way?